Only a decade after J.R.R. Tolkien created 20th century fantasy tropes with Lord of the Rings, Lloyd Alexander upended those same tropes in a delightful children's fantasy series called The Chronicles of Prydain, which makes Scott Bunn wonder,
Why is this not a movie?
Hello and welcome to Why Is This Not a Movie, the podcast where we look at a moment in history or a book or a story we can rip from the headlines and ask Hollywood why no one's ever put it onto the big screen. I'm Mike Vago, author and regular contributor to the AV Club. Joining me this week is Scott Bunn, friend of the show and host of Steve Sack Syndrome, indie sports radio show, which you can now hear as a podcast on your podcast app of choice or as a radio show on AshevilleFM.org. Scott, thanks for joining us. And let's talk about the Chronicles of Prydain and I guess our personal connection to it.
Yeah, I was going to say, this one feels like a joint podcast. We're kind of like not exactly pitching each other, more like sort of shaking the world by the shoulders and saying, make this a movie or make this a TV show, bring it to screen, because you and I have been sort of like mildly or super obsessed with these books since the fourth grade.
Yeah. So Scott and I have been friends for what, 40 years?
Something like that. Don't do the math.
Let's not say how old we are. Let's do it again. Scott and I have been friends since childhood. And our fourth grade teacher, Mr. DeLuey, shout out if you're listening, Mr. DeLuey, every day after lunch, he would read us a chapter from the Book of Three, which is the first book in this series. And that really got both of us hooked on, I guess not so much reading, because I remember reading a lot as a kid, but on fantasy books. Because then we went from here to Lord of the Rings and Narnia and, you know, all these things.
Yeah, and Mr. DeLuey, just let's give him a little bit of time because he was a really great teacher. And in fact, probably the first good teacher I had, you know, like before that, there were a lot of like sort of miserable women who didn't want to be there kind of teachers, you know, that's what it felt like.
And in fairness, we had a couple of miserable men who didn't want to be there.
Yeah. And then Mr. DeLuey was very much the like, hey, and he had been around for a long time, but he just had a like warm, engaging personality and wanted to teach kids. And that came through in his choice of book, The Chronicles of Prydain. But also like he did great voices. You know, I still hear the voice of Gurgi, like when I read, we'll get into this, one of the characters from this, I still have his voice in my head when I read that. And, you know, like, yeah, shout out to Mr. DeLuey. Like, we wouldn't be here now if it wasn't for him. So many thanks.
Oh, yeah. And I realized hearing you say that and just thinking back to this, him doing all the voices, like, he was great at engaging kids in, you know, the material in general. But it influenced how I read to my own kids because I always do the voices, even though my voices are like the old man voice, the gruff voice, and then like this one sounds like Sean Connery because I can do a Sean Connery impression.
Yeah.
Like,
right. Yeah, I could do, Gandalf was a really good voice because I could sound like John Huston, who did Gandalf in the animated Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. So that was like basically my only voice. And then like sort of just changing pitch, like if I was doing Merry or Pippin or something like that in Lord of the Rings.
See, my old man voice is, there's an old video game Diablo. And there's this old man who's like the old sort of wizard or whatever who gives you your missions. And when you click on him, he'll say like, stay a while, listen. And yes. So I just do that guy.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And side note, one of my favorite things, I love the movie There Will Be Blood, but one of the great things is that Daniel Day-Lewis did that entire thing, Daniel Plainview. It was a John Huston impersonation. So he was always like, I'm an oil man. And I was he's doing John Huston.
I never put that together. That's great.
Yeah. John Huston. Another whole podcast on him, but that's not what we're here to talk about today.
So let's talk about these books. It's a series of five books. And so that immediately begs the question, do you do five movies? Do you do a five-season streaming series?
Yes.
Both. Do them all. Yes.
Do them all. Yeah.
I mean, they're doing Lord of the Rings in every possible format. And a little background on Lord Alexander. He's an American author. He was contemporary of Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. I think he had some contact with Tolkien.
Yeah.
Like, I think they were sort of either, I think they may have been friends who wrote each other letters or that sort of thing, but he was definitely like, they weren't working in a vacuum. He was very influenced by Tolkien. But he was an American who was stationed in Wales for a while during the war and read up on Welsh mythology and based these stories on that.
Yeah. it feels like that was, I feel like Mr. DeLuey probably shared that with us, or it's in the foreword to all those books. And so it feels like the sort of like, oh, this is based on Welsh mythology, has just been something that I've just known about with these books, you know, since we were kids.
Oh yeah. Well, and one more thing about Mr. DeLuey, he had us all write to an author.
Oh yeah.
And I wrote to Loy Alexander and he wrote back.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I asked him a question about the ending of the book.
Uh-huh. Of and book he, of three or the whole?
No, the series.
Yeah.
Like what? Like the fate of Taryn and Elanway, who are the main characters. I don't know how to say this without spoiling it, but like I wasn't, you know, as a kid, I wasn't quite satisfied with how they ended up.
Right.
And he wrote back a really thoughtful answer that took my question, you know, as a 9-year-old boy, he took my question very seriously. That's and great. Gave me a really thoughtful answer. And that was like mind blowing to me that like these authors were, you know, kind of real people and who you could have a conversation with. And I think that put me a long way towards like wanting to be a writer.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't, it demystified it a little bit that like, oh yeah, this guy's just a guy who wrote these stories and he can talk to me about them. And, but also that he would just, that he would write to a kid 20 years after these books came out, you know, a nice little note about his question about the book. Like it was terrific. And I still like, he's still very dear to my heart for that reason.
Well, and yeah, we gave props to Mr. DeLuey, but like it, you know, I just read the Book of Three, you know, just a couple months ago with my son Levi, who's 10 in fourth grade, when we were introduced to these books. And yeah, Levi loved them, but just reading them, I'm like, this book is, you know, the first book, the Book of Three, it's just so open and warm and funny. And you immediately know who these characters are. And, but just, you can tell that Lloyd Alexander has a desire to connect with kids and has worked on that and is also probably naturally gifted at that as well. So before we dive into that, just wanted to share a couple of other personal history things with the Chronicles of Pride Aine. So I also read these, the Book of Three to my daughter Stella when she was about in third or fourth grade. And then she's an avid reader, and she was just like, okay, great. And she just read the rest of them by herself. And she was like, you read too slow, I'm taking it from here kind of thing, you know? And so I just like went to the used bookstore. They had them all, and I just bought them all up for like $15. And she was like, yeah, no problem. And she was done in like 3 weeks with all of them. So,
oh, yeah. which was the same thing we did in fourth grade. Like Mr. Exactly. Delivered the first one, he was like, oh, there's four more of these. And I was like, oh, to the bookstore.
What? Yeah. And so my other sort of personal history anecdote with this is when I was in college, one day I was in the stacks of the library, and somehow I can't remember why, what I was looking for. And so I was in the sort of kids fiction section, and I was like, I wonder if they have Lloyd Alexander. And, you know, I was probably a freshman or a sophomore. And I was just like, you know, I hadn't thought of him in years. And sure enough, the High King was there, which is the last book in the series. They had it there. And I just sat down and just started reading. And I was like, oh, I'll just read the beginning. And I got totally sucked in and I read the entire thing. And, you know, this is like being on my own for the first time. And I'm like setting my own schedule. And I was like, yeah, I want to sit down and read this book right now. And it didn't take me very long because, you know, you can fly through that book. And I was like, this is great. And yeah, and I just remember sort of feeling like an adult reading this book because I just decided this is what I'm doing right now while reading this kid's book in college. So yeah, that was a pretty good memory for Lloyd Alexander.
And I am kind of curious to read some of his other stuff because he wrote more than 40 books. These are just his best known, and The High King won the Newbery.
Yeah.
And the only other thing I've read of his is he did a short story collection that was kind of Pride Aine adjacent called The Foundling. And it's backstory on some of the characters, but it's It's like the opposite of the Silmarillion in that it gives you more background and detail, but it's a short, fun, easy read.
Yes.
But yeah, I'm going to echo what you said, that he's great. He's great at creating these really colorful, memorable characters. And there is a very like lived in warmth to everything. Mm-hmm. And it's a fantasy series. It's set in a sort of faux medieval Wales where there's magic and monsters and all sorts of things. But all the fantasy tropes to this day come from Tolkien. Mm-hmm. And he was only writing 10 years after Tolkien. He wrote these in the mid-late 60s. And he immediately upended them all.
Yeah.
Because let's actually get into what the story's about.
Yeah.
It starts off with Taran, who's I'm not exactly sure how old he is, but he's like a 12, 13-year-old kid who works on a farm. And he wants to be a great adventurer. And so the farm is run by Dalban, who's this very, very old man, and Call, who's kind of the stern, like, blacksmith. You know, the opening scene, he wants Call to teach him how to make a sword. And he's like, what do you want with a sword, kid? And, you know, swords aren't worth the trouble. You're just going to get yourself into trouble. But he wants to be a great sword fighter and adventurer. And he wants to be more important. So Call is like, oh, you want to be more important? I'm going to give you a promotion to assistant pig keeper.
Yes.
Because they have, a lot of animals on the farm, but there's one pig in particular, Henwen, who is kind of the, queen of the farm animals, and they treat very well. So it comes out. So Henwen runs away, and Taran chases after him, and that's how the adventure starts. But it comes out that Henwen is a magical pig who can see the future, and Dalban is a wizard. He's kind of the Gandalf, right. Obi-Wan figure in this story. And so basically every character in it isn't who you expect them to be when they're introduced, because you also hear Taran's idol is Gwydion, who is the prince and the great warrior and kind of he's not the hero of this story, but he's the hero within the world that they live in, within Prydain. And so Taran kind of pictures him as a sort of gleaming white knight in shiny armor and robes. And then you meet him, and it's not one of these meet your heroes things where he turns out to be a dick. It's that he's this like kind of hard bitten guy who's been living in the woods, and he's very down to earth, and there's nothing majestic or polished about him, because he's a, guy who like fights people with a sword. And it's not quite Game of Thrones where like, oh, he's a miserable bastard who,
right.
kills children or whatever. But it's just like, this guy knows how to like live off the land in the woods, and is like scrabbling through the dirt for berries, and is like, dirt kinked under his fingernails, and all the glamour that Taran thought was there wasn't there. And yet you realize, oh, this is how a hero would and should operate. And he's actually this really down to earth, like great hero, more than some puffed up, full of himself prince would be.
Right.
And so he doesn't just upend the fantasy tropes for the sake of upending them. He upends them to show you like, oh, the reality actually kind of means more and hits harder. And he gives you a very realistic look at things. So
I actually want to push back gently, because I think you're right in many cases, but also like this book is the template that Joseph Campbell lays out in The Hero with a Thousand Faces, the like small meaningless or seemingly meaningless person who goes on a great adventure, learns many things along the way, changes who they are, is able to, affect world events, but then comes back home a changed person.
Oh, absolutely.
Know? Yeah. So like, it still has that template.
But I guess that's what I like about it, that he follows that template.
Yeah.
But then he subverts your expectations.
Yes,
exactly. In a lot of different ways, in a lot of different places.
I actually have one other thing that's more about the world building.
Oh, well, let's talk about that first then.
Could we do that?
Yeah.
So one of the great things that I loved about Lord of the Rings, but also about the Chronicles of Prydain, also the Chronicles of Narnia, that's the other thing. He knew to use the word chronicles, just like Chronicles of Narnia. But this doesn't work great for our podcast, but I have this old book that my dad got for me at a used bookstore, and it's called An Atlas of Fantasy, the first major guidebook to the lands that never were. And it's the worlds of Tolkien, Burroughs, Milne, Conan Doyle, more than 100 Marvel-filled maps from the fanciful realms of literature and legend. And so there's great maps in the front of Chronicles of Prydain too. And they were actually slightly different for each of the books. And that, like going back through this Atlas of Fantasy in prepping for this talk, I was like, oh, I didn't remember that they slightly tweaked the map for each one, but it made sense because he went to different parts of the land of Prydain in those books. But then, you know, we got into Dungeons and Dragons a little bit, but we weren't really into it. But I remember buying a Dungeons and Dragons map that I loved. I love the map. And so then, again, more with personal history, we created our own Prydain, remember? Like out at the abandoned railroad tracks near our neighborhood, and we had all of these places.
Well, I took my kids back there recently and I remembered all the places.
Yes.
You know, like there were trees, like there was an undeveloped stretch of our neighborhood that railroad tracks used to run through.
Yeah.
And so we'd play there as kids, and we just named all this stuff after places in the books because all these places just felt so real. And like there were like a tree that was big enough to like hide under and make into a fort. Like that was the castle.
Yeah.
And I took my own kids back there a couple of years ago, and all those places came right back to me. And I was like, oh, this is Caer Dalbyn, and this is, you know.
That's great. That's great.
So these books loomed very, very large in our childhoods. And it's cemented that like any book that opens with a map, is it going to be good?
Yes, exactly. And that's one of the things about him, that he is similar with Tolkien and the other, you know, sort of seminal fantasy writers, that idea of world building. So not only are the characters, you know, memorable, completely great, and you're connected to them, but, you know, I wanted to go there, you know.
Exactly.
We wanted it so much that we created our own Prydain.
And one thing that he does that not all fantasy books do is that you return to these places a lot.
Yeah.
And there's also like travel time. It's not like late season Game of Thrones where they just teleport all over the realm. Like,
right.
So these places feel more real because there's a trope that I call burn all the sets.
Yeah.
Where this happens in, you know, sort of adventure kind of movies a lot. And in fact, Children of Blood and Bone, which is a terrific, like, recent YA fantasy book. The book is fantastic, and I'm not trying to, like, knock it. But the author creates these great locales that the characters go to. But almost every locale they go to, like, somebody attacks or something explodes. And, like, it's destroyed, and they run for their lives, and they go to the next place, and that's destroyed. And, like,
right.
They burn down all the sets behind them.
Yeah.
Whereas Prydain has a couple, you know, there's some books where you go to a place and you never come back again. There are a couple places that just get destroyed, but you keep coming back to some of the same places again and again, and it feels really lived, and it feels meaningful when Taryn's coming home, just like when like the Starks get back to Winterfell or Frodo comes back to the Shire. It feels like a real lived-in place.
Well, what I even liked, you know, no spoils, there's one location that does get ruined, but they actually go back to the ruins.
Oh, I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah, and so that, and like the ruins are actually on the map in the next few books. Pretty cool. So again, like there is one set that he does burn down, but it's still part of the world.
Yeah, yeah. Like nothing, these places aren't forgotten. They're all, they're still on the map. They're all still there.
Exactly.
So one kind of elephant in the room is that this already was a movie because Disney made, they combined the first two into The Black Cauldron. It was kind of at a rough period for Disney. It was their last hand-drawn animated film when that department was kind of being phased out. But it was also the first movie ever to use computer animation for some of the special effects. And it's kind of a hot mess. It doesn't really get rewatched or revisited. But I want to talk a little bit about the characters. Like I want to run down the characters, maybe a little bit of the story before we get to what Disney did wrong and what we need to do right.
Okay. And I've never actually seen the movie. I think it came out when we got a little bit older, so in middle school. So it's not like, hey, I want to run out and see a Disney animated movie, you know. And also, it was probably not in the theaters for very long. You know, we lived in like the world of 1988, where it's like, okay,
you know. Yeah, you didn't see the theater, that was it.
Yeah, exactly, it was gone. But yeah, go ahead and do the characters.
Oh yeah, well, so the first person Taryn meets, or not person in the loosest sense of the word, is Gurgi, who is this, Alexander describes him as looking like a windswept haystack.
Yeah.
And he's this tall, like ropey kind of monster who, when you first meet him, is terrifying. He's like hiding up in the trees and throwing things at him and threatening him. And then you very quickly realize that he's actually a coward.
Yeah.
And he just begs for food. And it's interesting because he's a sniveling coward, but he's also kind of good in a fight because he's this guy. Like, I kind of picture him as a shaggier Chewbacca.
And just, again, this is Mr. DeLuise's prime voice. Like, that's the voice of Gurgi. And he's also the, like, one of the most lovable characters in the book, if not the most lovable character. And he's very funny. And he was immediately Levi's favorite character, you know. And so there are other great comic characters in the series, but I think Gurgi might be the best one.
Yeah, he's definitely like the comic relief.
Yeah.
And the, you know, like Chewbacca, he's like just the stalwart best friend is with Taran through it all.
Yeah.
And then if I remember in the first book, Taran, I think, ends up kidnapped or captured and locked in a dungeon in a castle.
Yep.
And there's the princess who lives in the castle who like talks to him through the walls and befriends him. But like, it's funny because he has a very authentic reaction for a young boy, which is, ooh, girls.
Right.
And he sort of sees her as annoying, but she is also very headstrong and determined and like saves him and then is like determined to stick with him, even when he doesn't entirely want her. And so it's, her name's Alanwe, and there's a lot of Welsh influenced names where like spelling and pronunciation, the relationship is not easy to detect. In fact, I think the books have a pronunciation guide.
Yeah, they did for places and names, which was funny because as I was reading it this time with Levi, I was reading those names. And then at some point I was like, do I only pronounce these names this way because Mr. DeLuise pronounced them this way? And then I was like, oh, there's a pronunciation guide at the end.
Yeah,
like,
he just read the guide in the back. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, why isn't this at the beginning? But then maybe he didn't want to throw people off with like these weird sounding things into like, I need a pronunciation guide. I'm not reading this, you know? So I wondered about that. But yeah, that went through my head. I was like, do I just know this because of this one exposure I've had to it this whole time?
So Alanwe, you know, 10, 15 years before Princess Leia, she's like the princess who saves the hero.
Yeah.
And is very like outspoken and headstrong and also girly and silly in ways that are, you know, that are annoying to Taran, who takes himself way too seriously and wants to be this great, valiant hero. And so she's kind of there to just take him down a peg, which is a terrific relationship.
She's also very smart. She's whip smart, you know, and that's the thing that I think is, again, like, you know, Taran is this sort of headstrong, wanting adventure at the beginning of the story. And yeah, Alanwe is able to take him down a peg, but also he's just off-footed the entire time with her because he just hasn't had any exposure to anybody besides Call or Dalban, but especially this very sharp, very outspoken, not afraid to speak her mind. And he just never knows what to do with her. And I think it's some of Lloyd Alexander's best character building is actually with Alanwe.
Oh yeah. And she's also sophisticated in a way, you know, he's a farm boy.
Yeah.
And she's grown up in castles, and she also has what they describe as a bauble, which I kind of picture as like a crystal ball that's not quite so breakable, yeah, that she can make light up. And so yeah, there's some intimation that she has some magical powers that she has yet to develop.
Right.
And so she also just represents this much larger world. So he's also always kind of on the, like, yeah, on the back foot, as you put it, because yeah, not only is he kind of tongue-tied talking to a girl, I think he's also a little bit intimidated by,
oh yeah,
you know, this like magical girl who lives in a castle.
Yes.
And so either before or after Alanwe, they also meet Fluter Flam, mm-hmm, who is also comic relief. Mm-hmm. He's the king of a kingdom that you can walk across in a day.
Yes.
And it's never satisfactory to explain that, like, Prydain is kind of broken up into smaller kingdoms.
Yeah.
And so Fluter like takes himself very seriously, but he's just a goofball, and he plays excitement,
yeah, and exaggeration.
Yeah, he puffs up all these great stories, which turn out to be just him being, you know, full of bluster. And he's a bard, and he plays the harp. And he was given a magic harp, and he kind of doesn't realize that it's cursed and not a blessing, because every time he tells a lie, a string breaks.
Yeah,
and so he's kind of this buffoonish figure who, is just constantly telling lies and immediately being found out, and yet he never stops doing it.
Yeah. Well, the harp does serve as a corrective, and that's part of the arc of the story too, is how all of these sort of characters learn how to sort of better themselves. Like he was given the harp as a gift, and it's also like beautifully made and it plays beautiful tunes. And as Fluter says, like, I'm not this good at singing or playing the harp. It's kind of just doing it on its own. So it's just this another great image, great fantasy element that is so perfect for the character and the world.
Yeah, and one of the things I love about Fluter is that Fluter Flam, both his first and last name are spelled with a double F.
Yes.
And Lloyd Alexander is a double L.
Oh, yeah.
Fluter's the insert character. He put himself into the story, but he put himself into the story as this kind of, you know, blustery buffoon who's full of himself, which is great because, like, the big danger in writing this kind of story, the sort of red flag in fan fiction is when you insert yourself into the story as the great hero who everybody loves and, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's great that he wrote this character, this ridiculous character based on himself.
Yeah.
Who is full of himself, but also tells great stories and, you know, and is also like a loyal friend. And kind of like Gergi is also not cowardly the way Gergi is a little more craven, but Flute is more full of bluster. But then when it comes down to it, you know, he'll like step up in a fight and whatnot.
Yeah.
So we did Dalbin and Call, Gwydion, the great hero. And the first one also has a terrific villain, the Horned King.
Oh, yeah.
So there's references to, in the first book, and you don't see them until much later, Anuvin, the Land of the Dead.
Right.
Which is the Mordor of this series. And Aran, who is the Sauron, who, again, is kind of the shadowy demonic figure who you don't come face to face with for a long time. But his sort of acolyte in this is the Horned King, who is, you know, this sort of mysterious figure on horseback who wears a full like skull on his head.
Yeah.
And so he has this like skull head and antlers, and he's this terrifying figure if you're reading this as a 10-year-old boy.
And he's huge too. He towers over other grown men, let alone, you know, Taren. And
yeah. And he's the main villain in the first book, but the even scarier villain are the henchmen, who are the Cauldron Born.
Oh yeah.
Because in Anuvin, Aran has this magical cauldron that if you put a dead body into it, it comes out as a deathless zombie. And these zombies, they can be hurt, I think, but they can't be killed. They can't, you can only slow them down. And so his army is just steadily growing, but you can't kill them. So
yeah go ahead.
I was going to say, now is probably maybe is the time to talk about the Disney movie, but unless you have something to say first.
You did forget one of the main characters.
Oh, who did I forget?
Dolly.
Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah.
Dolly is a member of the Fair Folk, who are sort of a combination fairies and dwarves, I would say. And they sort of live underneath Prydane. They're not exactly human. Some are sort of short in stature, while some are also just the size of regular humans, I think, too. But they don't exactly like humans, but they sort of reluctantly sort of live in a symbiotic relationship with humans. And so recognize the danger of Arwen as like trying to take over all of Prydain. And they don't want anything to do with humans, but they're like, okay, I guess we should do it. But Dolly sort of comes across them in the middle of the first book, the Book of Three, and then he's in all of the subsequent books. And he had a power, or the rest of his family could turn himself invisible, but at least in the first book, he's not able to. And so he's a very gruff and truculent figure, but then, you know, sort of the sort of cliched, you know, gruff on the outside, but really is lovable on the inside. And he turns into good old Dolly, is the refrain as how they refer to him as. And he's like, get out of here. I don't want to do any of that. I don't want to help you. I don't want to do that. But of course, I'm going to help you. Let's go do it right now. You know, and like, if you're going to do it, we have to do it right. So I guess I'll have to do it. You know? Yeah. I love Dolly too, as a character.
And And two things that I love where, well, again, he kind of gently upends the tropes is rather than like, oh, we will send you our greatest warrior to help you on your quest. We're like, we don't like you. Just take this useless guy.
Yeah. He can't turn invisible. He should, but he can't.
Yeah, but I also love that Alexander's fair folk, like you said, they're kind of dwarves. They're kind of fairies. It's a little ambiguous, but he doesn't, you know, there are magical creatures in this, but he doesn't just take the Dungeons and Dragons template that,
yeah,
everybody for the last 60 years has ripped off from Tolkien, where like there are elves who live in the woods and they're effete and smart and kind of contemptuous. And there are dwarves who live under the ground and they have big beards and they're grumpy. And like, Jesus, it's fantasy. You can invent anything you want. Why are you just doing the same shit from Monster Manual or from the Player's Handbook? Like,
yes.
And so even though it's very much in the same vein as Tolkien and Narnia, whatever, he does put some effort into making his own fantasy creatures, and maybe it's just Welsh legend being a little different than the English mythology, yeah, that Tolkien was working from. But it's nice that it isn't completely to the template that a lot of fantasy has been just unwilling to stray from.
I guess
lack of imagination.
I guess they're more like gnomes than anything, rather than dwarfs.
But they're kind of their own thing, which I really like.
Definitely, definitely.
So now let's talk about the Disney movie. Because the movie was a flop, and it was kind of I don't know how not to adapt a book.
Right.
It was actually kind of the Percy Jackson of its day, because they had this successful series of 5 books, but they decided to combine the books and they made changes that hurt the characters and all this stuff. So what they did was they took the first 2 books and combined them together. So the second book is The Black Cauldron,
right,
where this, do you want to jump in?
No, go ahead. Okay. I'm just already like, why would you even do that? Like, if you're Disney, you're trying to create a series, why combine the two? Like, the first one's good.
Oh, I know. But I think they probably figured, I think a 5-movie series was not on anybody's radar.
Yeah.
When this movie came, you know, in the 1980s, when this movie came out. So I think they were like, well, let's make one movie out of all these things.
Yeah.
But yeah, the first movie, it's got a very good beginning, middle, end. It would have worked fine on its own. But The Black Cauldron is one of the high points in the series,
yeah,
for reasons that the Disney movie completely cuts out of the book.
Yeah.
So the story of the second book is, you know, some time has passed since the first one, but there's still these cauldron born, roaming Prydain, coming out of Anuvin, the Black Cauldron, this magical cauldron that creates these, you know, deathless zombies. They realize they're never going to defeat Aron unless they can destroy this thing and stop him from making more. And the worst part is, even if they do that, the Cauldronborn that already exist, they're still around. He just can't make more.
Right.
So even if they succeed, it's still really dangerous and still like a kind of a partial victory. But what's worse is whatever magic the Cauldron has to destroy it, somebody has to willingly throw themselves into the Cauldron and sacrifice themselves.
Yeah.
So it's a suicide mission. So they lay out this bleak opening for, you know, for Taran and his friends, and like the gang gets back together from the first book.
And also a large group, like, you know, Gwydion, and, you know, they have like elite strike team, but then Taran and his group kind of go off and do it as well. And they're like, again, sort of plucky underdogs, you know, like there's like these really great princes and warriors who are trying to do it. But then like Taran and their group kind of, because of their particular set of skills, are able to sort of, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Except they get stuck with Elidir.
Yeah.
Who is this like spoiled, obnoxious prince who's like the 7th son, which means he's not going to inherit squat. And he just has a chip on his shoulder. He's insufferable. He looks down on everybody around him, but especially the assistant pig keeper. And you just hate this guy. he's horrible. He's obnoxious. He's a pain in the ass. He's useless. He doesn't help them. He gets in their way. He undermines them, and they can't shake this guy off. But he's also like, he's a prince. He's important. They have to be nice to him. Yeah. And so it's like he's wonderfully written as, you know, just a huge pain in the ass. And meanwhile, they're getting close to the Black Cauldron, and Taran is kind of steeling himself for he's going to make the sacrifice. And you know, it's only book 2, and he's already gone from, I want to be the hero and do great deeds and be, you know, worshipped and have people sing songs, to be like, oh, this is what it means to be the hero. I'm going to kill myself to save everybody else.
Yeah.
And he's still a kid, and he's already kind of coming to grips with that. So it gets serious. You know, yeah, it's still a fun adventure and all this, but like the underlying themes are still presented for kids in a kid-friendly way, but he doesn't shy away from kind of the grimness of this.
Yeah.
So they go into Anuvan, they, you know, get past the Cauldron Born, and they do all these things with, you know, Elidir kind of chained to their leg. And they get there, and Taran is about to sacrifice himself, and Elidir, the spoiled, obnoxious, you know, rich kid who's been a pain in their ass the whole time, he shoves him out of the way and says, look, I know I'm completely useless, but I can do this one thing. And he jumps in the cauldron and he kills himself.
Yeah.
And it works and it smashes the cauldron. And it's such a great ending. It's because he puts so much into characterizing Elidir as useless and selfish and vain and all this stuff. Like, you don't expect it. And then when he does it, you're like, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense. This guy is lashing out at everybody else because he feels inadequate. He does genuinely want to do a good thing. Like, it's such complex characterization. It's such a great moment. It's so well written, and Disney completely ruins it because what they do is, first of all, you know, we talked about Gurgi is the really lovable comic relief sidekick, but he's also a little scary.
Yeah.
Because he's this like 7 foot tall, like hairy monster. And so Disney makes him tiny and cute.
Yeah.
He's like the size of a Smurf. And And so he's super cutesy, in a very, very Disney way. And they, because they combine the books, they strip out a lot of characters. I don't actually remember how they worked the Horned King storyline and the Black Cauldron storyline. And actually the Horned King conclusion was also great because Taran sort of wandered across the land looking for Henwen, the runaway pig. He finds the pig, and in his travels, he gets Gurgi and Fluter and Dolly and Elanway and all these people journeying with him on his side. And so they finally get to the big battle in the end, and they see the Horned King and his army, and they ride into battle, and immediately Taran gets knocked on the head and gets knocked unconscious.
Yeah.
And he wakes up and was like, did we win? Yeah. And they did. And, you know, Gwydion's there, and they won the battle, and Gwydion thanks him. And he's like, but I missed the battle. I didn't do anything. You know, this is like his dream is to be the hero and ride into battle and all this stuff.
Right.
But what he did was brought all these other people together and got them to work together and got them to, there's a little bit of Harry Potter in there where Harry's great power is that he's not a great wizard. He's not super powerful. He's good at getting people to help him.
Yeah.
You know, he's good at getting people to, you know, see that it's worthwhile to fight Voldemort or whatever. And so Taran is kind of the same thing. Like, he dreams of being the hero who rides into battle with a sword, but he's a kid. His real thing is that he gets all these people to like follow him and join him. And then they all fight. And the people who should be fighting, not the 13-year-old, fight and win this battle. But he plays this key role in it. And he's kind of stuck like feeling good and bad about that.
Yeah.
So, his endings are fantastic. And we'll get to one of the other endings in a minute. So I don't remember how they combine those two endings. But they do get to the Black Cauldron, and Gurgi sacrifices himself, and then they do the Disney of Death.
Oh.
Where, there's like a tear-jerking 30 seconds where he's dead, and then he opens his eyes, and, you could do a montage of, like, Baloo and just every Disney movie. And it's such a fucking cop-out. sorry to curse at you, Disney, but... And this is also, like, this is just before The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, like Disney revival.
Yeah.
In the 90s. This was kind of the low point.
And this is like a transition movie. Yeah.
Yeah. And there are some, and it's not like, it's not terrible. The animation is gorgeous. The Horned King is really creepy. And they have this like green fog that comes through the woods to represent some of the magic. And it's computer animated. And it looks really cool because nobody had ever done anything like it before. And like, it's still gorgeous Disney animation. It's the last gasp of their like hand-drawn cell animation, and they put a lot into it. So it's not, there are things to like about it, but they just kind of ruin the story.
It is on Disney Plus. Like, I have seen that. Like,
actually, that's true,
Going through Disney Plus, and I'm like, it's not as though they're burying it. There's lots of Disney things that you can't find on Disney Plus that they're like, we don't need to be talking about this, but... Black Cauldron is there, and it's not like it's buried. Like, it's one of those things. If you're like, if you like this, you might like this.
Right. Well, it's good that they didn't put it in the Song of the Southland, Phil.
Yes, exactly.
So yeah, it is still there. You can check it out, but read the books because it takes away a lot of what's great about the books.
Yeah.
Because it kind of Disney-fies and simplifies the story. So whether we're making this into five movies or a five season series, the first two, you kind of have a nice template of what not to do.
Yeah. Well, are we going to shift into what we want to do with this project?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was going to talk about the actual problems of the next couple books.
Okay, yeah.
Which is that, because if we're going through the books, we may as well just go through the rest of the books.
Go for it.
The Castle of Lear is Alanway's the main character in that one. And everybody else shows up, but it's the one that I remember the least of.
Yeah, it's the weakest one. Taryn's in that. It's still from Taryn's point of view. He's there. I can give you a quick summary on that. You know, Dalvin sort of kicks her out. Like, she's a princess. She needs to be raised as a princess. She can't be living on a farm in the middle of nowhere anymore. She needs to go back to her people. And Taryn sort of, you know, escorts her back to her homeland. And this is when the sort of relationship between Alanwë and Taryn starts getting a little bit more than just like, huh, she's intriguing, where there are hints of it in Book of Three that, yes, that Alanwë, I think, is clued into, I kind of like this kid, whereas Taryn's like, I have no clue what to do with you, you know? Whereas Castle of Lear, the third book, there's a little bit more that they have feelings for one another. But yeah, and so he gets to go back to her homeland and he's immediately out of place. There's castles, there's pageantry, and he's an assistant pig keeper. And like, that's always what's going through his mind. I don't belong here. I'm not good enough to be here. And she's like, what do you mean? You're my best friend. You should be here. I want you to be here. But he doesn't quite feel as though he should. And then there's a sort of big adventure that comes in, and yeah, Gurgi and Fluter sort of get shoehorned in. Gwydion's even there, and then there's another, the sort of big bad, the villain of this tale, you know, comes back from the Book of Three. I won't spoil that one, but it also includes the worst character in the Chronicles of Prydain, which is Glue. Do you remember Glue?
Not at all, no.
Glue is this, he's whiny and he's, I don't think he's from the fair folk, but he's just, he needs their help and he doesn't want to help them. And he's like, Elladir, you know, is also annoying, but Glue is just annoying and just the like, I really don't want to be reading about this guy anymore. And he's also friends with the giant cat who somehow only listens to Fluter Flam. And there's something about that storyline that I just never really got into. And the whole book kind of feels a little bit weird. Also, the island of Lear, where Alanwë is from, is off the coast. So it feels like it's not quite Prydain either. So yeah, and there's also a prince in there that that Taryn thinks that Alanwë is supposed to marry, and so and he's like a kind of lovable though very dull and dense character, Prince Rune. And so there's kind of like a love triangle there a little bit, but not like love. It's just like a triangle, but it's not my favorite one, I have to say.
Yeah, it's the only one where they don't travel.
Yeah,
really. And so, and there's less of an obvious adventure until the end. Like the story's about, ostensibly it's about Alanwë sort of having to be trained to be a lady, and she's already this rough and tumble adventurer.
Yeah,
at this point doesn't really want this, but it's actually about her coming into her magical abilities, and that's actually the real training.
Yeah.
So there is something to be there. I think some of the like, oh, you must be a lady stuff is maybe kind of dated 50 years later.
Yeah.
But I think you could probably tweak this a little bit and make it a little more like Arya Stark.
Yeah.
Who is supposed to be a princess and just, you know, wants to murder people. Like, I feel like this is the one book you would need to rework a little bit, which is a shame because Alanwë is a great character, and it feels kind of shitty saying like, oh, the one book about the girl is the book that's lame.
Yeah.
But there's just there's less of an adventure here, and there's less of a story, even though it does get into the characters. And also, just looking up on Wikipedia, because I've forgotten this book. Glue is a person, but he's a man who experimented with size enhancing potions, which is why he has the giant cat. And at some point, he ends up being a giant and stuck in a cave.
Oh yeah, that's right.
There's all these kind of misadventures, but I don't know. Maybe you write him out and replace him with something else. But the funny thing is, the thing that prompted me, we had talked. Like when I started this podcast, Scott just gave me like a ton of ideas of things he wanted to talk about, which is why you're a third time guest. And we both want to talk about Pride Ain. And I kind of had it on the back burner for the whole thing. And the thing that sparked like, oh, hey, let's do the Pride Ain episode now, was that Emily Vanderwerf, the great TV mm-hmm. critic,
yep.
was talking about these books on Twitter. And she posted a book cover of, I think, the last one that had the whole gang, and they were very recognizable in the illustration, and a giant cat.
Yes.
And I was like, is there a giant cat in these books? And I've totally forgotten. But Fluter keeps the giant cat. He apparently like kind of tames it with his music.
Yes.
And, you know, soothes the savage beast and whatever. But he continues to ride around on the giant cat for the rest of the series, which I love.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, I don't mind the giant cat. But I think Glue is in the fifth one, but has a much smaller role in it.
Well, I think almost everybody makes a cameo in the fifth one, because that's the... Actually, let's talk about the fifth one and go back to number four.
Well, yeah, and I'll say why we're going to come back to number four. He had, Lloyd Alexander had planned on doing four books, and it was supposed to go from Castle of Lear and then to The High King. And he was convinced by his publisher to say, like, you know, you have a little jump in time here, and there's a pretty big character arc that happens with Taryn. You might consider a fourth book that sort of connects the dots a little bit and gives us a little bit more Taryn.
I didn't know that at all. I love that.
Yeah.
And it's also, again, because we're comparing to the fantasy series here, Game of Thrones.
George R.R. Martin.
Yeah, George R.R. Martin. With Game of Thrones, George R.R. Martin had planned to do a trilogy and then do like a several year time jump. And then jump ahead to like Winter Has Come Now. Now here's where everybody is. Mm. And they drove a dump truck full of money up to his house.
Right.
And asked him to fill in that time jump, which means you got the fourth and fifth book, which are both weaker than the first three. Mm-hmm. And it means we never got book six.
Yes.
You know, if he had just stuck to his plan, the series would be done by now.
Yeah.
But I still want to talk about High King first and then Taryn Wanderer. But the fourth book is what is my favorite. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that it was as a kid, but as an adult looking back on the series, there's just a lot that I love about it. And so I'm so glad that worked out that way. I never realized that was an afterthought, but it's also telling the Lord Alexander, they asked him to shoehorn another book, and he makes this really rich character mm-hmm. development in this book. But the High King is, it's the last battle. It's the return of the king. It's the, you know, they're arrayed against the forces of evil, and there's a prophecy.
Yes.
And there's all this stuff. And so that, like, the whole, you know, almost everybody you've met over the course of the series comes in. And actually, I don't even know if there's a lot to talk about that one, because it is just a climactic battle. Yeah. And they're, you know, sort of defeat the henchmen and the villains one by one. And it goes the way these things go at the end of these series. But, you know, it's well done. And you've gained so much affection for these characters by that point.
Right.
But before we get to the big final battle is Taryn Wanderer, which is difficult for us to adapt if we're doing this, because there's been intimations from the very beginning. Like Taryn ends up on this farm because he's an orphan that Dalban and Call just find and take in and raise. And so there's these intimations early on in the series that his parents might be somebody important.
Right.
And that's how these things go in these books, like Harry Potter and Luke Skywalker and...
Even Rey from the third thing.
Oh, God, yeah. Well, actually, I want to talk about... how Disney ruined Rey, just like Gergi. Because there's an interesting parallel of, we're jumping ahead, but I think there's a scene in Last Jedi that's directly referencing Chronicles of Pride Ain. But let's talk about Taryn Wanderer first.
Okay.
So Taryn, in the beginning, by this point, he realizes he's in love with the Lanwei, but there's still the old thing about she's a princess and I'm an assistant pit keeper. And so, like, kind of like Spaceballs, he has to go prove that he's a prince so that he can marry her. And so there's been these intimations that maybe his parents were somebody important. So he sets off to find out his parentage. Yeah. And he does this by traveling across Pride Ain. And so there's a magical mirror up in the north, up in the mountains, that will show you your true self. And so he's like, oh, I can find this mirror. It's going to tell me who my parents are. It's going to tell me why I'm important and why I'm the main character. And so he sets off across the country with Gergi, and he leaves behind all the other characters. Nobody else is in the story, really.
Yeah. Some of them make cameo appearances.
Yeah, he runs into Fluter because Fluter like has his tiny kingdom. So he goes back, you know, in between books, mm-hmm. he just goes back to his tiny kingdom. So he comes across Fluter at some point. But the basic thing is that he leaves his friends behind. He goes off on his own with Gergi to find this mirror, to find his destiny and his true identity and all this stuff. But along the way, he keeps meeting these other people who need help with various things. And so he keeps abandoning his quest to go help people. And at one point he kind of settles down with this this older farmer or something who like needs his help.
Yeah.
And so he keeps putting his own desires on hold to help other people. So he finally gets to the mountains. He gets to the mirror, and it's just a pool of water. It's just a puddle.
Yeah.
And he looks in it and he sees himself. And that there's no magic. He just sees himself.
Yeah.
But in looking at himself, what he realizes two things. One is that he's not the kid who was the assistant keeper anymore. He's grown up to be a man. And he hadn't really seen himself that way. And he realizes, like, this is the person that I've grown up to be. And he also realizes, it doesn't matter who my parents are. I'm the hero because I'm the person who put my quest on hold to help all these other people. And because I put other people's needs ahead of my own. And that's why I'm the hero. And it doesn't matter who my parents are. I'm the hero because of the choices I made. And that's such a terrific message, especially because it's such a leaden fantasy trope that, you know, oh, your parents are great wizards. Your father was a Jedi. You're only important because of who you were born into. It's this very like sort of monarchist, you know, you're only important if you have rich parents.
Yeah. And I love your description of Terran Wanderer. For me, I immediately thought, this sounds like the song The Weight by The Band. Like, you know, because he like keeps like trying to do something for himself, but they're like, you know, Crazy Chester followed me and he caught me in his vault. Take Jack, my dog, you know, feed him when you can. Like, he just can't ever do what he's supposed to do because he has to do all these other things that people are asking him to do.
Right. And he kind of puts the weight of the world on his shoulders, but it's because he legitimately like wants to help people and sees that he's making the world better by helping these people one by one.
Take a load off Taren.
Yeah. And so to bring this back to Star Wars.
Yes.
I really, always. Well, there's that scene in The Last Jedi when there's that pit on the Luke Skywalker planet that's calling to Rey, and she dives down there and there's a mirror.
Yeah.
And she sees herself and she sees the endless reflections of herself. And then like Kylo Ren tells her, you're a nobody. And I really thought that was a direct reference to Terran Wanderer. She sees a mirror that just shows herself as an ordinary person and that she's a hero because of the choices she made. And the Force reaches out to her because of her innate goodness. And like, which just got ruined by that terrible third movie.
Yeah.
But my theory that Rian Johnson based that on these books is reinforced by the, what is it? The character in Knives Out is like Harlan Thrombo, I think.
Yes.
And there's a Choose Your Own Adventure that we also read as kids around the same time who killed Harvey Thrombo.
Yeah, that's
and right. He said, oh yeah, this is a direct reference.
Yeah, and Rian Johnson, he's our same age. He probably had Mr. DeLuey as a teacher.
Exactly.
Yeah, so, yeah. Well, and also it made me think of the very end of The Last Jedi where there's those small kids who are sort of like servants or something like that, or orphans. And there's the one who's kind of sweeping, looking up into the stars, and then sort of puts his hand out there and the broom comes towards him. Again, a nobody, an orphan, but...
he's an assistant bantha keeper.
Yes. It is slightly different from Taren, who's, you know, doesn't have any magical powers. He's significant because of who he is and because he can connect with so many different people. So it has a slightly different thing, but it, at least in The Last Jedi, the message is anybody can have this power. Anybody can be helpful in this whole thing instead of just like, yeah. And then it's subverted where it's like, oh yeah, Rey is like the Emperor's granddaughter. And you're like, what?
Just so dumb. And he's alive for no reason. Ha ha.
Yeah.
I would love to, speaking of why there's not a movie, I would love to see like Rian Johnson's continuation of the story, or at least somebody who understood Rian Johnson's story that continues with the ideas that he was talking about in Last Jedi. And at some point, I guess I can announce this now. At some point, I want to do a like sort of set of special episodes on this series called Fix This Movie.
Ah.
Where we talk about like movies that were almost good, movies that just made some bad choices and how to make them better. And that's like top of my list.
Ooh, I like that. I got to start brainstorming for that. I'll get you seven.
And I'm actually thinking I'm just going to bring back former guests. It's just going to be an all-star lineup of people.
I love it. That sounds great. Okay, let's make this movie.
Oh, yeah. So who do you see as a director?
Well, first I wanted to say... This should not be animated.
Yes.
Yeah, it needs to be live action because I do believe, you know, I've watched some great animated fantasy stories. You know, I'm thinking of all the, I can't remember his name, but it did Howl's Moving Castle and all of those.
Miyazaki.
Yeah, Miyazaki. Yeah, those are terrific movies. I love them. They're such a specific tone and a specific world. Each one of them, I mean, they're not even connected. But at the same time, I want to see this live action. And one of the things that I love about it is it needs to be either filmed in Wales or a place that feels like a stand-in for Wales, too. There's this old joke. I don't know if you ever saw the movie Kicking and Screaming, not the Will Ferrell soccer movie, but the Noah Baumbach's first movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I love this movie. We can talk about it another time. It's a totally different thing, but it's about these hyper-educated college kids who have just graduated, and then the big story is like, what do you do after you graduate college? Like, I don't know what to do. And so, like, the girlfriend says, like, I'm going to Prague. And he's like, oh, I've been to Prague. I haven't been to Prague, but I've been to Prague. And so I've actually been to Wales, and I've been there, and I've been to Wales. I've actually been there, and it does look like Prydain, like every turn. Like, and so I feel like it needs to be filmed there or, you know, whatever. If it's like, yeah, there's too many modern houses, like you got to do it in Slovenia or something like that. Okay, whatever. But like, it needs to have that feel of a lived in place where you can do this sort of correct world building.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to do like, wow, Prydain looks so much like Southern California.
Yeah.
But I think like Game of Thrones set up shop and so many old castles across the British Isles that I think you could probably just dust off those sets. And
yeah, they were great. Director, I have a few, but there are two that I'm really excited about.
All right, let's hear it.
The first one is Greta Gerwig. Because she's so good in, I'm blanking on her great movie. What was it called?
Frances Ha?
No, the one.
Little Women?
Little Women is great, but.
Lady Bird,
yes.
Her but
Lady Bird and Little Women are very much about characters at this age, you know, that Taryn and Olanwe are sort of middle school, high school. She's really good with young people and getting those emotions put out. So I think Greta Gerwig would be really great in bringing this to life. That's choice number one.
Yeah, I love that. I'm gonna be better than that.
Second one is much more specific, and part of me worries in the direction it would go in, but Wes Anderson, who's also terrific with kids at this age, young adults, Moonrise Kingdom, and also Rushmore, and also like Isle of Dogs and Fantastic Mr. Fox. Like, Fantastic Mr. Fox is a great movie. And I don't know if you've ever actually seen that. It's animated. Yeah, yeah. But I don't need them to all be the, like, very specific. I don't want to see what's-his-name from Rushmore in this movie at all, who's in all of his movies.
Oh, Jason Schwartzman?
Jason Schwartzman, yeah. I don't want Jason Schwartzman anywhere near this movie. And, like, Wes Anderson might actually ruin what's great about these books, but he also could make it fantastic. So those are my top two choices.
And one thing that Wes Anderson does well, is understanding the importance of location and props.
Yeah.
Because there is a thing, I don't know about Taran, but a lot of the characters have an object associated with them, almost like the Teletubbies.
Yeah, right.
But Fluter has his harp, Alame has her bauble.
Gurgi has the wallet of food that never empties.
Oh, that's right. At the end of the first book, they're all given magical gifts by the kings or something. And so they get Fluter gets a golden harp string that'll never break. Gurgi is always hungry, and so he gets a wallet of food that never empties. But they're all kind of not an ironic twist, but they're all slightly flawed. Gurgi has this never-ending bag of food, but the food always tastes a little stale.
Yeah.
And I forget what Taran gets. I feel like Taran doesn't get anything, and there's some lesson in that.
Gwydion doesn't know what to give him, and he asks Taran, you can have anything, and he says, I want to go home.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. Which is the sort of full circle of the hero's journey from a hero with a thousand faces.
Yeah, exactly.
The only other two director choices that I thought, Guillermo del Toro, who did Shape of Water, and especially Pan's Labyrinth. Just having an idea, and he also did Hellboy, which I've never actually seen.
But he's so good. He's so good with creature design, and you can have some fantastic looking cauldron born, and he could probably make a giant house cat that doesn't look stupid.
Yes. And also the Horned King would be awesome. The Gwythians, we haven't even talked about the Gwythians. And then the last director choice, this might just seem too obvious, but is Jon Favreau. I mean, Favreau, did so well with Iron Man and then with The Mandalorian of just okay, what do we want out of a Star Wars story? Keep it very simple. We go town to town. What's cool about Star Wars? It's about these kind of objects, but it's set in the West, cool creatures. And he's really good about what is necessary in a story. And I think he would do pretty well with Lloyd Alexander.
Oh yeah. Even if you get him to direct the first movie or get him to set up the series and then hand it off to the directors the way they did with Mandalorian.
Yeah.
But give him the overarching. Yeah. He's somebody I would trust with any franchise.
Yeah, me too.
If you're trying to make this into a franchise.
Yeah.
I did not have anybody nearly as good, to be honest, as your choices. I had the Duffer Brothers did Stranger Things because they clearly understand how to work with kids and how to do an adventure. And it'd be interesting to see them do fantasy and not quite in the sci-fi horror vein that they're doing. But there are some horror elements in this. There's zombies that you can't kill. There's the guy with a skull on his head. There's some scary stuff that I think they could do well.
Yeah.
And then my left field choice was Andrew Stanton, who has... he's one of the Pixar... He's one of the main Pixar founders. He directed WALL-E and Finding Nemo and Bug's Life. And so, but he also did John Carter, which was his sort of ambitious live action failure. That it's one of those movies that it didn't do well. It wasn't very good, but there are film lovers on Twitter who will passionately defend what he was trying to do.
Yeah.
And it's a grand sweeping adventure and that sort of thing. But he's also low key been directing television in the last couple of years. He did a couple episodes of Stranger Things. He directed some of Legion. He's been directing For All Mankind and doing episodes here and there. And so especially if it's a series where you rotate in a couple directors, it would be great because he's one of the founders of Pixar, or not one of the founders, but one of the first directors they had on board. He clearly understands how to make appealing stories for kids. And I was looking at maybe whoever's directing Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, because that's also a kid, around this age group. But I think your stuff is better, and I would love to see Greta Gerwig do something like this. That's kind of outside of her wheelhouse and yet plays to all of her strengths.
Yeah, I think she would be great. Let's get her on the phone right now.
Oh yeah, I would love to see that. And also, she's just somebody who, as a director, as an actress, I loved everything she's done, and I just wanted to make every movie.
And you can tell, the adaptation of Little Women, she knows books, she loves them. She could figure out, Jon Favreau, okay, what's great? What's the essence of this book? We need to make sure that's in this series or movie.
And to jump into casting, in the first book, when Taran finds Alame, she's living in this castle, and there's this evil witch, Akrin, who she puts Taran in a cell, and Alame frees him. And you think like Akryn's this, you know, sort of evil magical queen, and Alanwë is like, you know, being trained in the arts of magic by her. It comes out later in Castle of Lyr, where Akryn shows up again, that she had actually kidnapped Alanwë, and Alanwë didn't know it.
Yeah.
Telling her, I'm going to teach you magic, but she was actually trying to get her to grow her power so she could steal it.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like that could be a really fun scenery chewing role for anybody, but for Gerwig.
Oh, I like that.
If she
that.
Were going to direct this and insert herself, that's where you'd cast her.
That's beautiful. I like that a lot.
The thing about casting, you know, I always joke in the show that if I don't know young actors, I just go to the Stranger Things cast. They're already too old.
Yeah.
So I think what you need to do is for the young, for Taryn Alanwë, I think you need to cast unknowns.
Yeah, I think so too. Because mine are lame, like, and they're older than the Stranger Things kids. Like, I was like, oh, Tom Holland, like, it could be Taryn, but when he was 13, you know. Speaking of Greta Gerwig, I thought of, I can never say her name.
Oh, Saoirse Ronan?
Saoirse Ronan for Alanwë. Like, I looked her up and she's 27. I'm like,
well, exactly. Yeah. If you could age them down 10, both them both down 10 years.
Yeah. I do have a good Fluter Flam who I don't think it's explicitly said, but yeah, considerably older than these folks. I kind of like Tom Hiddleston, you know, who plays Loki.
Oh, yeah.
And he is also in the Night Manager series. But yeah, he's Loki. He has the, you know, first of all, he's blonde or fair, which is what Fluter Flam sort of is. Spiky blonde hair is how Lloyd Alexander describes him. But also just like Loki is kind of a humorous character as the series goes on. And so I feel like he could play that humor aspect of it.
Yeah, I had Stephen Merchant.
Oh, I like that. Yeah,
because he's described as being kind of tall and lanky, and I just picture him as this kind of this, you know, tall, lanky, kind of goofy guy tripping over his own feet, but also taking himself very seriously.
That's perfect. Yeah,
I do want to say one thing about casting about you know, him being like a blonde, fair guy. Mm-hmm. Like one thing about fantasy, and Game of Thrones ran into this a lot. They got a lot of knocks for not having diverse casting.
Yeah.
And the kind of dumb defense is like, oh, but it's historical based on the history of this land with dragons and ice zombies. Like it's fantasy. You can do anything you want, even if it's based on Welsh mythology.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to only star Welsh people.
Yes.
And especially because you have these different sides of the kingdom and these very different places. And you also have this kind of high and low, like class conflict between the Sons of Dawn are like the royal family.
Yeah.
Like Gwydion is among the Sons of Dawn. They live in the castle in the north where they rule the kingdom. And then you've got these kind of down at heel, like pig farmers.
Yeah.
Even though one of them is a wizard. And so you could, you know, you could do some diverse casting, particularly Taryn. I think you could get somebody who is maybe biracial or like ethnically kind of ambiguous because you don't know where he's from.
Yeah.
And so you don't necessarily want him to look like other, you know, sort of groups of people or factions of people in this land. You kind of be like, where, you know, where is this kid even from?
Yeah, and Dalbin and Call, those are great characters. I mean, I like the idea of like the Gandalf character being a person of color, you know, and yeah, that's a great idea. I do have a casting idea, a casting idea for Gwydion that's mostly just a joke.
Okay, let's hear it.
But for Gwydion, I was like, well, a Sean Bean type, you know, like, you know, someone who's, you know, sort of looks rough and is flawed or scarred or some way and old, but also can dress up nice. But when I looked up, I typed up like actors who are similar to Sean Bean. I just typed that in just to see what it would. And it got to a website that said, actors who always die. And Sean Bean was there. And I was like, you know what? Gwydion, not that no spoilers here. Like, he doesn't die, but I'm like, maybe we should just cast Sean Bean. Like,
well, I actually think as a bit of meta casting, it'd be funny because now you're just expecting Gwydion to die.
Yeah, exactly.
And so when he doesn't, it's like a reverse Game of Thrones. We're like, wait, they can't not kill off Sean Bean.
But I do love this, that there is a site that was like actors who always die, whose characters always die.
Yeah, it's like him and Steve Buscemi. And
yeah, exactly.
Actually, as much as I just talked about diverse casting and would love to do this, I actually had a white guy for Call.
Mm-hmm.
Because actually, I don't know if this is good or not, but the only real details you get about Call is that he's bald. Taryn kind of doesn't have a lot of respect for him because he sees him as this blacksmith who is trying to keep Taryn from going out into the world adventuring. And at the end of the first book, when Taryn finds out Henwen's actually magical and can see the future, there's a legend of this great warrior who went into Anuvin and rescued Henwen from Aran, the evil, guy. And so in the very end, Dalban tells him the name of that great warrior was Call. And so he's actually this retired warrior who is actually really tough, and Taryn doesn't like sees him in a new light.
Right.
And this is maybe too left field, but for some reason I was thinking Paul Scheer.
Yeah, I could see that. That would be great.
Because I was just looking at bald actors.
Yes.
And and he's somebody who actually, I'm getting this from the Marc Maron interviews with him and Jason Mantzoukas.
Yeah.
Because, this is a podcast. They're big podcast guys. So, but Mantzoukas always plays a maniac.
Right.
And when you hear, off camera, he's this genial, like, music nerd.
Yeah.
Who, went to college for, like, music theory and religion and is this very, like, just, intelligent, soft-spoken guy who always plays, like, a psycho.
Yes.
Whereas Paul Scheer is this very genial pushover, and he had this abusive childhood, and he was just fighting kids all the time as a kid and, like, kind of got into comedy as, like, an outlet. And I think there's some real, like, toughness to Paul Scheer that we don't ever see on screen.
I like that a lot.
That's and so I think he could sell that. I think it would be, like, cast against type. Because he would be great as the disarming kind of scolding blacksmith who you don't see as a figure to take seriously. And then you're like, oh, wait a minute, this guy's actually a huge badass.
Yeah, you went there and did what?
Yeah, because a lot of this is challenging Taryn's notions of what a hero is and the reader's notions of what a hero is.
Yes.
And so I kind of like that for that reason. Dalban, before the show, you were just like, let's just get Michael Gambon and do his thing again.
Yes.
But I do like the idea of, like, not casting white people of all this and getting...
Right.
I don't know, like, maybe Ken Watanabe, who's done that kind of figure in other movies, and also just kind of look at, like, okay, who's over 60?
Yes.
Because Dalban's supposed to be, like, 100.
Yeah.
And so just, like, who's the oldest guy who's still working who we can put in this thing? But I didn't come up with a name for anybody. Yeah. And the Horned King never takes his mask off, so that can kind of be anybody. And for that, maybe you want somebody, I think you want somebody like Hugo Weaving, who, mm-hmm. Like his Red Skull in Captain America, you never see his face, but his voice is just so commanding and good.
Mr. Anderson.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he can create a whole character without you ever actually seeing him.
Yeah.
Maybe like Michael Shannon, who just has this, like, commanding voice and is intense. And also, again, you don't have to go with a white guy there, but just somebody who is, or like Michael K. Williams.
Yeah.
Or, somebody who just can be commanding and terrifying. And can act without you actually seeing his face.
I thought Michael Shannon was the best part of Guillermo del Toro's Shape of Water. He was great and funny and scary at the same time. I'm all in on Michael Shannon stuff. I think he needs to be in more stuff.
Well, he's great in that he's this super intense actor who can still also have a sense of humor.
Yeah.
Actually, if Wes Anderson directs this, Willem Dafoe, because he also is in that box.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I feel like Gergi needs to be a sort of, he's a CGI sort of creation, like an Andy Serkis type thing, somebody with Mr. DeLuise's voice, that's able to create a character. And similar with Dolly as well.
Let's get Mr. DeLuise. He's retired.
Let's just get Mr. DeLuise. Yeah.
Well, I actually think you could definitely do Gergi mocap. I kind of feel, just because I sort of think of him as being a sort of a shaggier, Chewbacca who speaks English, I feel like you could do a guy in a costume because he's larger than the average person, but not gigantic. Like, he's not impossibly tall. That's actually another thing on, like, how to make this movie, apart from who makes this movie, is you could do a lot of CGI, but I don't know that you have to. I think you could do a lot of practical effects because there isn't a ton of magic. There are some, like, mythical creatures, but a lot of them are like a giant cat. Like, they're kind of down to earth.
Right.
So I feel like you could sort of make your own Chewbacca-like costume and just get a really tall guy and have somebody do the voice. And again, like, Mandalorian has shown you can do something that's almost entirely CGI and make it feel really real and lived in. But I could see you just shooting this on Wales, or shooting this in Wales and kind of doing it old school without a ton of special effects, because even though there's magic and stuff, it is still a pretty grounded story.
Yeah.
I don't know if you feel one way or the other about should this be a series or should this be movies. I kind of feel like I'm envisioning this as a streaming series because that's what all the stuff is these days.
Yeah. I think just as long as there's enough runway to land the plane. Like, they need to have, there just needs to be enough time to tell these stories. I actually think like 5 2-hour movies is actually probably fine, you know? Or if it's a series where it's just like 45 minutes each and you sort of do it over an extended period of time, I think that's fine. But just don't combine them. Don't try to do one movie to tell the entire story. Like, yeah, don't do that. Like, you've got the real estate, use it.
Oh, exactly. And actually, now that I think about it, this isn't Lord of the Rings where they're just huge, you know, bricks of a book and there's a ton of material. He, you know, Alexander creates a lot of really colorful characters and great locations and stuff, but he does it pretty briskly.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, they're books for like middle grade readers. So they're short books. So yeah, I think you could do these justice in movies without cutting a lot of stuff out. And I think you would have to write more material to pad them out to a series unless you did like a bunch of 6 episode.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, because that's what I was thinking about with Book of Three. I was like, you know, I'm sort of fresh off of reading Lord of the Rings to Stella, where I was just like, oh my gosh, we've been reading these for like a year and a half. And whereas Book of Three, I read in like 2 weeks with Levi, you know, like it's really quick, you know. So I think it doesn't need that much, but at the same time, do it right.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think part of me is leaning towards movies because we haven't been to a movie theater in a year and a half.
Yes.
And like, it'd be great to like have a movie to take the kids to that is made by someone other than Marvel.
Exactly. Also, it's the name of the podcast.
Well, exactly. All right. Well, so that's our movies. Thanks again to Scott Bunn. You can listen to his radio show, Steve Sack Syndrome, on Asheville FM. And I didn't really plug the show enough in the beginning. It's a kind of a thinking man sports talk show, where, you know, you guys talk about the NFL and the NBA and that sort of thing, but you'll also have guests on to talk about like volleyball and racquetball and history of, I don't know if you've ever done racquetball.
Yeah, we haven't done racquetball, but the way that we like to say, it's a sports talk show for people who don't necessarily enjoy sports. You know, we'll sometimes say, hey, did you see the game? But we try to bring a sort of comic look at sports. And also, we're not going to sort of break it down with stats and everything like that. But mostly, we're interested. We have a guest on every week, and we're interested in their story and how they interact with sports, whether as a fan, whether as a participant, as a coach. And, you know, we usually just say, okay, you're watching the Chiefs in the playoffs. What are you wearing? Are you standing up? Are you eating? Is anyone else left allowed in the room? So it's those kinds of questions.
Yeah, like what are your superstitions?
Yeah, that we're most interested in. And so, yeah, that's kind of what we do with Steve Sack Syndrome.
And I do really like sports for the stories, because there are a lot of great personal, you know, stories for the fans, for the players, for the, you know, the history of it. And so that part of it really appeals to me. And it's sort of the opposite of sports shouting from 30 Rock.
Yes.
So that is on Asheville FM. And if you live in Asheville, North Carolina, it's on the radio. But it's also a podcast now. So anywhere podcasts are found, you can listen to it after the fact in an easily digestible form. And you can find my column, Wiki Wormhole, in the AV Club every Sunday. And you can read student journalism, hear college radio, and listen to other lesser podcasts on our parent website, subjectmedia.org. Oh, I should actually plug a few of our podcasts. The Subject Podcast Network has grown. We now have Advanced Blockbuster Studies that have been doing episode by episode recaps of the Marvel shows. And we'll take time to talk about other like kind of big popcorn entertainment as it comes out. We have Lead On, which is a staff member and student at the University of Buffalo interviewing people about leadership. They recently talked about somebody from NASA and how she got that job and how she, you know, became an astronaut, which is really cool. So check that all out on subjectmedia.org. Stay safe out there. Get your shot. Keep wearing a mask. We'll be back next time on
Why is this not a moon?